2 a.m. Tuesday, March the 23rd, 1993. This is the House State Affairs Committee meeting. Would the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Harley Olbert.
Here.
Representative Betty Davis.
Here.
Representative Pete Cott. Representative Jerry Sanders.
Here.
Representative Gary Davis.
Here.
Representative Fran Ulmer. And Representative Albies.
Here. We have a quorum present this morning. The first item on our agenda I'm going to take up is HCR 10. We have someone here to give our sponsor statement on HCR 10. Jeannie, would you please step up and join us at the table and state your name and affiliation there?
Good morning, I'm Jeannie Smith, aide to Representative Foster. HCR 10 fulfills federal mandate under which lack of our compliance will cost the state of Alaska about $9.6 million in fiscal year 94. That's the federal fiscal year, which is this year. Same amount in 95 and 19.2 in the following years. The funds for this come from the ICE-T Act, which is the Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act, which is the federal government's way of refunding 14.1 cents per gallon that we pay when we buy gasoline. This money is currently built into our capital budget. Public Law 101-516, which was passed, directs each state to enact laws requiring 6-month revocation of driver's licenses of those persons convicted of any kind of drug offense, not even necessarily while driving. And there's two options. One is a bill option, and I won't cover all the problems with that one unless you have further questions on it. We have decided upon the resolution option, which would require the passage of the House and Senate, and then the governor sends a certified letter to Washington, D.C., stating that such has happened. If you look in your packets at HCR 10, item number 2, it basically states that we are concerned with the abuse and of drugs and alcohol in our state, and we would like to continue addressing our drug and alcohol problems at a state level and eliminate federal compliance and control. If we don't, if we pass a law and the bill did not meet the federal compliance, they would withhold those funds. HCR would ensure that we wouldn't have to deal with compliance changes in the future or at this time, and also that these funds, if we fail to comply in the following years, there would be no question as to trying to keep up with federal standards on this.
Thank you very much, Ms. Smith. Are there any questions of this morning? Ms. Smith is the Committee Secretary for Transportation. Representative Ulmer?
Just to clarify, so if we do not pass it by April 1st, the $9 million that will be withheld for the next fiscal year?
That's correct, and we'd have to eliminate it from our capital budget.
Are there any questions? This, Representative Olbert?
This resolution satisfies the federal requirement and we continue to get the money?
That's correct. We have based it on other states. There's 4 examples in your packet here.
This format does work even though it says we are opposed to revoking driver's
licenses. Let's clarify that. That's a very good point. We have in our packet the excerpts from the Federal Register. Kimberly, would you get my personal file out on this where I've highlighted these different sections and make it easy for me to find? passes. I have spent too much time reading federal regulations on the federal registrar, but I've never seen anything like this in my career, and that is that we have a federal law that says if you don't do what we tell you, we're going to take away your money. And this is the first time I've ever seen it where they put in a clause in there, unless you tell us to go fly a kite, and then we'll give you your money back. And that's what they've done here.
This is a new concept.
I've never seen it before.
So we're dealing with the go fly your kite.
We're taking the go fly a kite.
Well, if I'd have known that.
Okay, right?
Yeah.
If there's no further discussion, then I'll entertain a motion. Representative Betty Davis?
I'd like to make a motion that we move out SCR 10 within the recommendation.
Okay, we have a motion to move House Concurrent Resolution 10 from the House State Affairs Committee within the bill of recommendation. Individual recommendation, and the next committee of referral is HESS. Would the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Gary Davis.
Representative Davis, we're calling the roll.
Is my name called?
Yes.
Representative Fran Almer?
Yes.
Representative Jerry Sanders?
No.
Representative Albizzi?
Yes.
Representative Pete Cott?
Yes.
Representative Harley Olberg?
Yes.
Representative Betty Davis?
Yes.
HCR 10 has passed from the House State Affairs Committee, and we'll be going to the next committee referral. The next item on our agenda is HB 37, which is now the second sponsor substitute for HB 37. I see Representative Davis is with us this morning. Representative Davis, if you'd like to join the table. If you would, please state your name and where you get the paper together there.
Okay. My name is Representative John Davies, and I'm speaking to you this morning on House Bill 37, which is an act that would amend the Open Meetings Act. I assume that you have in your packets my sponsor statement sections. I'll just go down that quickly. In section one of the bill, we've deleted all of the list of governmental entities that constitute governing bodies and move that down to a definition section at the end of the bill. So I just want to point that out, so not eliminating those that we'll find later on. Section two limits the restriction on taking an action in executive session. And actually, that was in the original version. And what I want you to notice that in the sponsor substitute, the modifications to the executive session have been totally removed from the bill. So there will be no modifications to what would happen under executive sessions. Section three requires notice of meetings to include the subjects and provides that in certain cases. 72 hours notice before meeting. Then the definition of meeting is taken up in the next section, and that's really the heart of the bill. And I presume that you've read that, but it's a definition that specifies that the test of whether or not you have a meeting is a majority of the quorum. And that works out to be approximately a third of a body, more or less. I'll get into more of the details of the reason for this, for providing this language. The problem, I think, to leap ahead a little bit, is that we've had conflicting court cases that try to define what is a meeting and whether or not a certain what this would do is provide a very specific definition in the law so that there was no ambiguity, so that people had a very clear standard to work from. And it in no way, in my opinion, changes the basic thrust of the Open Meetings Act, which is that all business before the public ought to be done in public. I would like to read in my sponsor statement. I have proposed amendments to the Open Meetings Act because the existing statutes are vague and need clarification. The present law does not define what is a meeting and omits critical information from the notice requirements. The result of these shortcomings has been a series of expensive and contradictory lawsuits that would have been avoided if the law were clear. In the case of Cummings and Schechter versus the City of Fairbanks, Superior Court Judge Savelle has taken the most extreme possible interpretation of the Open Meetings Act when he instructed the jury that if only two members of the governing body met without appropriate notice, they were in violation of the law. In every case in the United States where this question has come before the state Supreme Court, the court has affirmed that a meeting only occurs when at least a quorum of the governing body is in attendance. Asserting that two members of the governing body cannot engage in informal discussions of the issues before the body not only breaks new legal ground, it violates common sense. The amendments to the Open Meetings Act that I have proposed in House Bill 37 strengthen the act by giving a clear definition of a meeting, making the notice requirements more complete, and providing reasonable penalties when the law is violated. Departmental staff who are currently subject to the law would be allowed to discuss business without satisfying public notice requirements. The definition of meeting proposed in House Bill 37 provides that a meeting occurs when a majority of a quorum of a governing body assembles and discusses issues before the body. A majority of a quorum would be just that. If you take the quorum at the body, for example, an 11-member body like many assemblies around the state are, a quorum would be six members. A majority of that quorum would be four. So if four members of an 11-person body were together, that would be presumptive evidence that a meeting occurred. If three or fewer for an 11-person body were to meet, that would be permitted. Informal discussions of that number of people would be permitted under this law. Serial meetings are explicitly prohibited. Currently, there's no, the law is silent on the issue of serial meetings, and this has been one of the contentious points in many of the court cases around the country. Two or three people getting together, deciding something, then getting together with another two or three, doing this in serium until effectively a quorum has been reached and an issue has been decided without having a meeting at all. That's explicitly prohibited here. So that's another place where the law is strengthened. The current Open Meetings Act requires only that reasonable public notice shall be given for all meetings. The notice must include the date, time, and place of the meeting. That's according to present law. If these amendments were to pass, we would require that the notice be given at least 72 hours in advance of the meeting, and that the notice should include the subject. Under most of the rules that we operate here in the legislature, for example, we require that the issue to be discussed is also part of the notice. That's not part of the present Open Meetings Act, and I believe it's an oversight that needs to be rectified. Now I'm getting to the issue of what the appropriate remedy should be. Act is violated. As it's now written, the Open Meetings Act requires that actions taken in a meeting which is in violation of the Act are void automatically. HB 37 gives the court the discretion to decide to allow the action to stand if it is in the public interest. And I want you to read that language. That in the second sponsor substitute is slightly different than in the first sponsor substitute, and the difference is one of emphasis. It says in the second version that the court shall find the action void unless it makes a positive finding that it would not be in the public interest to do so. So it requires a positive action on the court to not void the action. The appropriate action that may be taken against a public official who knowingly violates the Open Meetings Act would be an ethics complaint or a recall election. If the knowing violation resulted in personal gain, there are other statutes that provide for similar criminal lawsuits. And the reason for providing this is that, especially in many of the smaller communities around our state, it's difficult to find people who are willing to run for public office at all. If we add the additional onerous burden of the possibility of individual lawsuits in a situation that may be gray, I think it's going to be even more difficult to find people who are willing to serve in public office. And sort of an overview of this situation. It seems to me that, that no law can guarantee that the behavior that it seeks to prevent will not occur, but that a good law sets a clear standard of acceptable behavior that when reasonable people can understand and follow it, it provides for certain consequences if it is proven that the law has been violated. The present Open Meetings Act does neither one of these things. With the amendments given in House Bill 37, the Open Meetings Act will be a better law. It will be more clearly understood. It will be workable and have appropriate penalties. And the end result will be a sunshine law that people can respect, understand, and obey. I have received, Mr. Chairman, and I don't know if you have copies of all these, but a number of resolutions from various entities and municipalities around the state. I'd just like to mention a number of them. There's a resolution from the Alaska Municipal League. There's a resolution from the City of Unalaska. There's a resolution from the Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference. There's one from the City of Barrow. There's one from the City of Sitka. There's one from the City of Fairbanks. There's one from the City of Indiana. And from the Alaska Tourism Marketing. We'll hear, I believe, from representative of the Alaska Municipal League or one or two in a moment, so I won't go say much about those. I also want to point out that a few years ago, the Open Meetings Act was the subject of quite a bit of debate in the Juneau area, and I have a copy here of the Juneau, a resolution adopted by the Juneau Assembly that adopts a series of guidelines about how to implement the Open Meetings Act in this area. And I would note that this set of guidelines allows a 9-member body here, as I understand it. It allows 2 members to meet and discuss things in common. So long as that discussion doesn't lead to a substantive decision about how to take a certain action. That's the guideline that the local assembly here in Juneau has adopted. Lastly, I'd like to get to the issue that really triggered, in my mind, the reason why we needed to finally propose these amendments. This has been a problem, in my estimation, that's been festering for quite some time. When I was elected to the Borough Assembly in Fairbanks in 1989, I asked for the municipal attorney to give me some guidance on the Open Meetings Act. That attorney and no other municipal attorney that I had spoke to was able to give me much comfort, that I knew what was a violation and what wasn't a violation, what I could do and what I couldn't do. And the reason for that is that the present law does not define what a meeting is. There is no definition of a meeting. So I think that's the fundamental reason why the existing law is in the vernacular broad and needs fixing. Let me just illustrate the effect of this. It has been that a number of contradictory and relatively expensive lawsuits have transpired around the state. And I want to just mention 2 of those. Judge McLeod's Judicial District in Taylor versus Cordova, 25 July 1991, said on page 4 of his decision memorandum, this court is satisfied that a single meeting of 2 members are not, quote, meetings under the law, and that the issue turns on whether a series of one-on-one conversations constitutes a meeting. So Judge McCoskey specifically said that 2 members meeting was not a violation. He further observed that the Open Meetings Act prohibits meetings, not the communication of ideas, and that the Open Meetings Act does not prohibit the serial lobbying of individuals that would be lobbying by members not on the body. Contrast that opinion with the 4th District Judge Bell's instructions to the jury in Schechter versus Cummings versus the City of Schechter and Cummings versus the City of Fairbanks. And I just want to read from you his instruction number 21 to the jury in that case. Judge Seville wrote, a meeting for the purposes of the Open Meetings Act occurs when 2 or more members of the City Council deliberated about city business. He defines deliberation as examining, weighing, or reflecting upon the reasons for or against the question under consideration, even if there is no agreement or commitment about how the members will vote. He goes on to say, deliberation also includes collective gathering or exchange of information. So this is in direct contrast to Mikulski's, I'm sorry, I can't pronounce that name, instructions in the other superior court case. So this is the dilemma, I think, that we find ourselves in, is that we have contradictory results from the courts. We've had a series of expensive lawsuits that resulted from this lack of clarity in the Open Meetings Act. And so I believe that House Bill 37 rectifies those situations. I'd just like to close by noting that I also have here a file that contains a number of the amicus briefs that were filed in an appeal to that Cummings and Schechter decision. The appeal by the City of Fairbanks argued that council members did not violate the spirit or the letter of the law, and the City of Fairbanks proposed that the test should be whether number one, two or more members met privately, that number two, they took action or deliberated, and number three, that the number of people meeting was sufficient in number that they effectively controlled the final action, so that this would be consistent with the Brockwood versus Anchorage instructions that the judge said that the number of people meeting was not the important issue, but it was whether or not they had the effect of controlling the final action. That's also been the kind of test that was in a famous case in Wisconsin, the Lynch case, used a similar test. The City of Kenai also filed an amicus brief. There were so many people who wanted to file amicus briefs that the court limited the number of amicus briefs that could be filed by category, so there were certain categories of briefs filed. In the City of Kenai, I argued in the same way that the key issue is whether the number was sufficient to control the outcome or that the result of the meeting.
Representative Davis, I don't mean to interrupt you, but could we limit the testimony to the bill? We don't need to get into the court.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I have only about three more observations I want to make, and then I'll wrap it up. I also want to point out that there was a joint brief filed by the school districts around the state. They argued the same way as the City of Kenai.
Please, we really don't need to inundate ourselves with the court history here. I mean, it is somewhat interesting, but it's also getting very redundant. So let's try to move on and discuss the bill.
Okay. I'll just close by saying that there were a number of these. The reason why I think it's important to note that there were quite a number of briefs filed by a lot of different entities, not just municipalities, but school districts, the University of Alaska, is that it was felt that this decision of Judge Bell went so far as to make the Open Meetings Act effectively unworkable, and that's why we're here today.
Are there questions of Representative Davis? I think Representative Davis' summary remarks summarize it very well. We currently have an Open Meeting Act which is simply not workable. That's, I think, recognized by a lot of people. I don't know the different opinions of people at this table. The question is how to fix it. And are there comments or discussion about the proposed changes in the second sponsor substitute for House Bill 37? This bill has been in the mill virtually the entire session. This has just recently been finalized, has not Representative Davis. While Representative Davis was working on his bill, I too recognize that this is a problem that we need to address, and I prepared a bill, which I have not filed yet, on the same subject. It's interesting to note we address many of the same problems, but we address it in a very different manner. So with the leave of the body, I would try to make a brief comparison of the two bills. One, in the bill that I had prepared, I have simply defined a meeting in the quorum. There's not a quorum present, there's not a meeting. HB 37 defines a meeting as a majority of the quorum. I went on to clarify, this is a matter of law, but since lawsuits were the subject here, two items that are excluded, I went on to clarify that matters involving privilege, attorney-client privilege are excluded from the Open Meeting Act. This is a right that the Supreme Court would grant anybody, but since it wasn't in the Act, it could be a subject of litigation. I went on to change the phrase, shall be voided by law if there is action taken contrary. This section to that it may be voidable by law. Very somewhat simpler, less burden of proof than we have here in HB 37. In order to discourage frivolous litigation, which would simply cause a body's actions to be annulled, the body would go back and reenact them again, I have put in there that in a court proceeding to enforce this section, all parties shall bear their own costs and attorney fees. That section would only take effect if this bill was passed by two-thirds of both houses. If this bill did not pass by two-thirds of both houses, that section would be null. I further went on, and in the first paragraph, I deleted the requirement that agency materials that are to be considered at the meeting shall be made available at teleconference locations. I simply felt that was too burdensome, was really contrary to the purpose of open meeting. It would discourage teleconference meetings rather than encouraging them. We would not want to have the action of a body voided simply because one of many myriad of documents is not present at a teleconference location. I further went on and deleted the portion that required that votes at the meetings held by teleconference should be taken by roll call, simply because I felt it was redundant. The requirement of Open Meetings Act is that the votes be taken in a manner that they can be identified. If that can be done other than roll call, such as by unanimous acclamation, a roll call is redundant and a waste of public time and money. I believe that summarizes the changes. If there, the committee has questions, well, we can go over it. If there is not objection, I will file this bill for the committee's further consideration at another meeting. The committee can compare the two and decide which method of amending the Open Meeting Act to choose to take. Representative Ulmer?
Mr. Chairman, is there additional testimony this morning?
Yes, we do have two persons, I believe, signed in. One, we have two persons signed in to testify on HB 37. President Davis, thank you very much. I know you've worked hard on this bill. It's a difficult subject. It's one of those things everybody has an opinion on. We all know it's broken. We just don't know how to agree on how to fix it. Thank you very much. We have a Mr. Kent Swisher with the Alaska Municipal League. Mr. Swisher, do you wish to testify on HB 37, or do you merely have here for questions? Or?
Mrs. Walker and I, who are president, who is our president, rather, would like to speak very briefly.
Okay, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
My name is Rosalie Walker. I'm currently a member of the Juneau Borough Assembly, and this year I'm the president of the Alaska Municipal League. I simply want to say in brief opening that I really appreciate Representative Davies taking this bull by the horns, because we've been trying to get someone to start out with this for quite a while. And in talking with several of the legislators, many of them are a little apprehensive because it's a media situation. And some of them, one point blank told me, say, I'm not going to get into that fight with the media. But I contend that the media doesn't have to live with this law. We do. And it has been a real difficult matter to deal with the Open Meetings Act as it stands now. I want to assure this group that the Alaska Municipal League believes in the concept of open meeting law. We believe that the public has a right to know. We believe that the public has a right to participate. But it has become such a burdensome thing and such a very expensive item that we feel that we need to look at it and give us a little guidance and clarification here. We have small communities who are in violation every day if we go by one or the other judge's rulings. We have right here in Juneau, even though we've worked very hard to set up guidelines and so forth, there are times we are sitting right on the fence. If the wind blew either way, we could fall either way, because of the way that the law is interpreted. There are communities that, for instance, Cordova, this last time, people would not run for office simply because of the Open Meetings Act. And one young man jumped in 3 days before the election and had a write-in in 3 days and won the seat. and he was relatively new to the community, but he was able to do that. People are really having a hard time trying to comply with the law, and we want to comply. And I appreciate your efforts, Mr. Chairman, in adding your input to it. And I look forward to working with you and anyone else to help clarify this thing. The amazing part is this does not cost any money. It's costing us money to try to comply with it, but you don't have to allocate a dime. Just put your brain power to work and help us out in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Olman.
Two quick questions. Would it be helpful for us to pass this law this year instead of waiting for next year?
Representative Olman, Mr. Chairman, Representative Olman, should have been passed last year and the year before that. The sooner the better, I think, because of there are communities hanging out there. Fairbanks is one. And it has cost them quite a bit in the league, and as Representative Davis pointed out, others are coming to their rescue. There's some others who are kind of holding up to see what happens here or in the court. So I just feel like it's an urgent matter. I really do.
My second question relates to the quorum issue. The chairman's indicated that a different way of defining an open meeting is a quorum versus a majority of the quorum. And I just wonder if you care to comment on that. There seems to be two different ways to go. And I just wonder if you have a feeling for whether the open meeting should be defined as a majority of the quorum or the quorum of one.
Well, truthfully, personally, I have no druthers on that. I simply want some guidance by which to work. Either one would be workable to me, but I think there were some members in the league and some of the city attorneys who had some differences of opinion there. Mr. Swisher may speak to that, but personally, I don't care.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Thank you very much for taking time to be with us this morning. Swisher, do you have a statement you wish to make?
Very briefly, Chairman of the Committee. My name is Kent Swisher. I work for the Alaska Municipal League. Recognizing that you spent a substantial amount of time on this morning and that you have many other things to do, I will be very brief. We certainly support HB 37, and we would like to continue to work in that area. It is the league's position that a quorum is the standard we would prefer. That's certainly one of the subjects for debate, but that is the standard that we do prefer as a matter of policy. We're also, we'd like to have one further thing in a piece of legislation that's not there now. And we'd like to clarify that a group from a community can come and speak to a public official without violating the act. I would imagine that each of you have had delegations come, and each person in that delegation takes maybe a piece of the problem, and when they're through, they've given you a good holistic community view. We'd like to continue to be able to do that in addressing public officials. That, between the two of the measures discussed, that really does cover the things that the league seeks. As Mrs. Walker said, we're trying to create a situation in which local public officials can go about their duties and know that they're not violating. Right now, for example, CITRA requires two on an ordinance for introduction. So obviously two people have got to talk. And if that's illegal, we've got a problem. While this bill is broken, and we appreciate your saying that, in the larger communities, it's utterly shattered in the small ones. Imagine trying to live with this in a community of 300 people, and we have to run governance there, too. With that, I'll conclude. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. We have Ms. Wendy Redmond has signed in to testify on HB 37. If you would, please.
My name is Wendy Redmond, the Vice President of University Relations for the University of Alaska Statewide System. And I will be very brief. I think Representative Davies already indicated the University of Alaska Board of Regents filed an amicus brief in support of changes in the Open Meetings Act. The guts of this bill, which is the definition of meetings, was in fact the focus of our amicus brief, which was the definition of a quorum. But the language in House Bill 37 excuse me, is acceptable to us with the further definition of what kinds of meetings are applicable. So we very much support this legislation. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Representative Elmer?
Do you have a preference as between stating that a meeting is a quorum or a majority of a quorum?
Our preference would be a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Redman. If there are no additional questions. Okay, are there any further comments from the committee on Representative?
Just very briefly, I do agree with Ms. Walker that we probably have delayed on this issue about as much as we need to delay for purposes of the communities doing their work. And I just wonder if it might be more expeditious to simply prepare a committee substitute for House Bill 37. We've heard a couple of suggestions this morning that a group can speak to public officials. The teleconference issue you've raised, I don't have a preference one way or the other. The may versus shall is a very simple amendment to make. And if a majority of the committee would prefer quorum versus a majority of quorum, we could simply change that. I mean, there really isn't a lot of point in introducing a whole new piece of legislation. There's a long-standing tradition in this body. You just go with a piece of legislation that's in front of you. We're over halfway through the session. It seems to me we could do a CS for 37 and get it out of here this week and stand a much better chance of actually getting this measure passed this year than if we put it off any more than we agreed.
I would just briefly explain that I did not propose it in the form of committee substitute because I had not discussed it with the original sponsor. It is a sensitive subject. I did not believe that the, without consultation, that the sponsor would necessarily want his name identified with the bill after changes had been made, because I knew the sponsor had done a considerable amount of work on the bill and was concerned about the consequences of the decision. Now, if the sponsor would like to make that suggestion, it would be a simple matter to make a substitute. Either way, I think we can have this matter before us for resolution on Saturday, so I don't think that we're talking at time delay either way.
Maybe we should ask the sponsor to
President Gary Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I take it to understand that you and the sponsor will have a meeting. Is that correct?
As long as that's not violating the open meeting act, we'll do that. Representative Davis, do you have any additional comments you'd like to make at this time? I'd like to invite you to join us at the table, but our table is kind of limited.
Mr. Chair, I would have no problem making some of the changes that were proposed in the form of CS. I would, however, just like to comment for the, I think the committee should have some discussion, and I don't know when you wish to have that discussion about the issue of the central issue of how we define a meeting, whether it's a quorum or a majority of a quorum or some other test. And I don't know if you want me to do that now or at some other time. I do have, as a result of having spent a fair amount of time and kind of being on point on this issue, I've received a lot of input on that point, and I'd like to share some of that with the committee at some time.
Feel free to do so at this time. I wasn't trying to cut your testimony short earlier, it's just there were some things that aren't really germane to our action here, and that is the horror stories of all the court actions that have occurred over the last 2 or 3 years.
The issue of the number of people that constitutes a meeting is an issue that's been before a number of different courts, and there is no standard solution to that problem. And in fact, I think the Brookwood case in Anchorage and the Lynch case in Wisconsin, in both of those cases, the court specifically did not provide a particular numerical test as to what constitutes a meeting. And the reason they did that is because it depends on the circumstances. In certain cases, if the action is effectively controlled in a override situation, it may be that three or four people can actually control the final action on a particular issue. So the courts, I think, have not wanted to specify a particular number. That's sort of one issue. If you read through the court literature, the question of trying to actually pin down a number, especially if you get as large as a quorum, is something the courts have clearly shied away from. But not in every case. There are many Supreme Court cases around the country where the courts have found that a quorum is, in fact, test, and the logic there is you have to have a quorum to take action. If you want to take actions, it's going to be a meeting, you have to have enough people there to actually take the action. So that thing, though, I would say is that kind of being on point and having been the recipient of a number of editorials and a number of, I've spoken in a number of forums around the state, I think that people in Alaska want a more stringent test. I think what you'll find is that if we propose a quorum as the test, there'll be a lot of resistance to that notion because it goes, I think in many people's mind, it goes too far. And that was the original version of the bill that I put forward, had the AML position in it as a quorum. And the reason I changed it to the majority of the quorum was as a result of the feedback that I got from quite a number of people around the state that thought that really was pushing things too far. Many people, in fact, the Fairbanks Daily News Miner has editorialized many in the press club in Fairbanks have said that even allowing two people to speak in an unnoticed meeting is going too far in their opinion. So I think that there's a wide divergence of points of view here, but I would think that it would be fair to say that the majority of Alaskans want a very stringent test. They want our business done in public, and they want a strong law that says, that defends that point of view. So I would be concerned that if we use the quorum test, that those people would be concerned and that we would meet a certain amount of resistance as a result of that. The attorney-client privilege issue, I actually had some language in one of my versions, and I took it out because it got muddled, and I finally decided it wasn't worth it. I don't care about that one way or the other. We can craft some language that makes everybody happy and isn't so broad that every meeting becomes an executive session, then I'd be perfectly happy with that. On the issue of voiding the action, the language that I have in my second substitute, I would slightly prefer, but I don't think it functionally changes things very much. But again, it's sort of the perception. Say it shall be voided unless the court finds it's in the public interest not to do that. It's a slightly stronger emphasis, a slightly stronger message that we think that this is an important issue and that the actions, you got to be real careful about what you're doing in terms of potential violations of the act. The individual parties, I don't have an opinion on that. I need to think about that some more. Agency materials, I do have I think I would have a slight disagreement with the chairman on that issue. If you're going to have a teleconference and you can have people talking about an issue, the materials that are available at all the sites around the state to talk about it, in some, at least in some abbreviated form, or ought to be available. I think otherwise it's if people who are listening in on the teleconference really don't have a way to follow what's being discussed. If the bill, for example, isn't there. Finally, on the issue of votes, as long as the votes are attributable, I don't have any problem with making a change to that. That's, as you correctly pointed out, that is what's in our Open Meetings Act discussion or ethics, the new ethics bill that we passed. The issue is that the votes should be attributable to individual people, unless it's by acclamation, in which case it's unanimous, and you can therefore attribute a yes vote to everyone or a no vote to everyone. So that summarizes my feelings on those issues.
Thank you very much. And I would point out one thing, regardless of which bill the DOP is looking at, there is nothing in either one of these bills that precludes any political subdivision of state from adopting more stringent requirements. They can impose more restraints on themselves.
And Mr. Chair, I think that's a good and excellent point, and I would just like to remind people of the policy that was adopted by Juneau, and I think that's an excellent example for other municipalities to follow, too. In the same sense as the legislature has their ethics law that goes and kind of interprets how we will deal with, in our case, with the Open Meetings Act, I think it would be a good thing for most municipalities to have their own sets of guidelines about when notice, how notice will be given, how many, what vehicle the numbers will be, those kinds of things. I think. So I think that, and those procedures that local municipalities adopt can be more stringent. That's absolutely right.
Thank you very much, Representative Davies. And I was reminded that I accidentally called you Representative Davis earlier. Okay, we will defer further action on the Open Meetings Act until our meeting Saturday. At this time, I'd like to go to the next item on our agenda. That would be quickly, I'd like to move to SB 90. Then we will be getting on to HB 65. I hope we can finish that up today. Time permitting, we'll go on to HB 197. We have any persons here on SB 90? Senator Lehman? Are you with us this morning? I guess obviously you are. Would you care to make a statement on SB 90?
I haven't decided if I'm here yet. Mr. Chairman, I'm Lauren Lehman. I'm the Senator for District G in West Anchorage and its environs. And I'm the prime sponsor of Senate Bill 90. If you'd just take a minute to look at it, if you already have had a chance. I think the sponsor statement, if you looked at it, covers detail. We'll reread it, but it basically is meant to clarify the responsibilities of the Commissioner of DEC and the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. There are some ambiguities in the statute that we in the legislature passed in 1990 in the aftermath of the oil spill, which we passed then said that imminent or actual oil spill catastrophe would be a disaster even without the governor's declaration. And what this bill does says that either of the two commissioners could request the governor to declare that disaster, and upon declaration then the forces would be set in motion to respond to that disaster. This is consistent with the statutes on hazardous substances. And it's also consistent with the memorandum of agreement that the departments have worked out to iron out the differences. It was brought to my attention by the departments, and I think it is consistent with good public policy and the other two. Section 2 of the bill just makes a very minor change. It says the Commissioner of Military and Veterans Affairs, instead of the Director of the Division of Emergency Services, would be the one to request it. Those are the changes. It passed, I believe, without objection in the Senate. Not that that's, of course, has any bearing on what you do.
We don't refer to the other body around here.
The other body doesn't.
I don't blame you sometimes.
You're in limbo.
No extension is very suspicious.
Are there questions of Senator Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, I just have a question. I read it in. I mean, are we making a policy choice, I guess, in this
consideration? No, there's, as you recall, we had quite a discussion on the floor of the House on who should be primarily responsible. And, you know, as it turns out, DMVA is for, let's see if I can even get this. I remember the discussion, but there's a big argument over that. And this really doesn't change who's primarily responsible for what. They've already worked out those details in their memorandum of agreement between the two departments. And it just makes it consistent with the Hazardous Substance Act, and it's also in Title 46. Well, I was reading it earlier, but yeah, it's 4608 until it's 80 maybe, or I remember what it is. But anyway, It's housekeeping, I think, to clarify in statute what actually is happening and probably what should be happening, because the governor is required to make that declaration anyway, and we really need the declaration made to set in motion everything that needs to be set in terms of response, emergency response to spills.
Further questions of Senator Lehman? Are there additional persons who wish to testify on SB 90 this morning? Morrison?
Yeah.
that's the reason we ask people to sit at the table. But you were speaking fairly close to the microphone. So. If there are not any questions, I will put a motion on the table that we, or I will put a motion before us that we pass Senate Bill number 90 from the House State Affairs Committee with individual recommendations. Would the committee secretary call the roll?
Representative Peacecott?
Yes.
Representative Fran Albert?
Yes.
Representative Gary Davis?
Yes.
Representative Betty Davis?
Yes.
Representative Jerry Sanders?
Yes.
Representative Harley Olberg?
Yes.
Representative Ellen?
Yes. The Senate Bill number 90 has passed from the House State Affairs Committee with a unanimous vote with individual recommendations. Senator Lehman, thank you very much for being with us this morning, Mr. Chairman. The next item on our agenda is House Bill 65. We have before us a committee substitute that should be in everybody's packet. We have not formally adopted the committee substitute. Before doing so, we can certainly have discussion. Are there, before we adopt the committee substitute, or try to get into comparisons. Mr. Studi with the Department of Labor would like to testify on HB 65. Mr. Studi, would you care to join us? I don't have any other person signed in to testify on HB 65. If there is, why please indicate at this time.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Don Studi, Director of Labor Standards and Safety, and addressing sections 44 through 48, and I was here for any questions. As I stated previously, the reason it was written and the way it is written is to make these fees user fees. The reason we wanted them set in regulation is so it was more responsive to changes that were necessary. The amount of these fees are set in our 94 fiscal year 94 budget.
President Olmer?
Just to clarify, so the budget, which is currently before House Finance for the Department of Labor, assumes that the bill passes, giving you authorization to raise the fees to generate the revenue to pay for the service that's being approved in the budget.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olmer, that is quite correct.
So these things are like tied together, and if the bill does not pass, giving you the fee authorization, the budget that is being deliberated in House Finance is not an accurate portrayal of what services will be rendered under your division, correct?
That's correct. It will be less the amount of the fees.
Okay, and approximately how much is that, just to remind us of what?
The fees that were taken from general fund to program receipts to make it self-supporting of the programs was $93,500.
And that $93,000 in FY 93 was paid for by general funds, or?
That's correct.
Okay, so we're transferring from general funds to user fees. The service level will remain the same, or is it reduced?
The service level will remain the same.
If the fee authorization doesn't pass and so you don't get to do it, what will you not be doing with the problem?
What we will have to do is lay off additional personnel and cut back on travel funds. If we take it from the electrical inspection side, it will reduce the amount of inspections within the state by 25%. Right now that equates to approximately 422 inspections. Taken from the other groups within mechanical inspection and reduces service by about 50%.
Thank you.
Further questions of Mr. Studi? Mr. Studi, thank you very much for being with us this morning. We have before us a committee substitute for House Bill 65. Make sure you have the same version everyone else is looking at. The work order number at the top is 8-GH1020,
downside of raising those fees is that it is a direct tax on the working men and women of the state of Alaska. Getting into the Department of Natural Resources, it sets up in statute the fees that the Department of Natural Resources may charge, as opposed to granting them regulatory authority. This is found in section 42. Going on to section 43, it has been added that it incorporated the existing regulation that provides special privileges to disabled veterans. It was not in the other bill, it was in regulation. Going on to 44, we address the Department of Environmental Conservation. The Department of Environmental Conservation has recently enacted regulations. We have removed their regulatory authority in that area. We have brought the regulations into statute, and we have proposed numerous changes in those regulations. We could go over them. The Department of Environmental Conservation had anticipated, I believe, somewhere around $750,000 in fees from these regulations. That number will be greatly reduced. I don't know the amount. Going on, we don't make any additional changes in the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board or the transition clauses. Attached to your package should be the regulations from the Department of Natural Resources and the regulations from the Department of Environmental Conservation that we are adopting in the statute and amending. Are there any questions at this time? Representative Gary Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I've discussed some of the recommended changes in the State Affairs Substitute Bill as it relates to the Labor and Commerce CS. The story from each department is, as was just testified by the Department of Labor, the budgets that they have established for this year reflect these fee increases. These fee increases, it's my understanding that last year each department was directed by the legislature to review their fee structure and make appropriate changes, I suppose. I'm not exactly sure what the direction was. That's my understanding of what the direction was. We have two veterans that could certainly correct me as to the details of that. Having sat through the DEC Finance Subcommittee, it's hard to, I feel we made some drastic cuts there. Without these additional user fees, which, as you indicate, are taxes. I don't think there's any hiding that. I'm just concerned, but I'm also concerned about the department's active movements of late in establishing user fees, the actual amounts. But that's from everywhere. That's every department's been doing that. They've been doing that for a couple of years, I believe. So it's obvious that we have an opportunity here to somewhat start looking at putting the brakes on that and getting more involved. But somehow, after having sat through, like I indicated, the budget subcommittee with some of the departments, it's really hard to imagine a complete operation serving the public, doing their public duty as dictated, without these additional fees. So it is a dilemma, both philosophically and in details of exactly what degree you might feel is appropriate, what degree the public might feel is appropriate, and what degree I feel might be appropriate as to the amount of fees. I believe most of us probably agree that those who initiate appreciate a service, need a service, utilize a service, need to be the ones to cover the cost of that service. So, you know, that's a, that gets in the way of miring up this water a little bit also. I really, at this time, I just feel a lot more comfortable with the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute. That's the end of my testimony.
Okay. Further comments at this point in time?
I'd like to hear from the person that spoke just a few minutes ago how he feels about the new proposed CS. Has he had a chance to look at it?
I believe that Mr. Studi's testimony was about the difference, yes.
Well, you were referring to the difference and saying that would meet the requirements that you have in the
Excuse me, Mr. Studi, would you like to join the table if she's going to ask you questions? I don't think that Representative Davis, I will clarify that the fees that the Department of Labor is requesting are in
the fees
are in the committee substitute by Labor and Commerce Committee. They are not in the committee substitute.
That's what I understand. That's what I want him to address. If the fees are not in here, are you supportive of this? Because you just said you had it already written into the present budget, proposed budget, that is.
That's correct.
And if those fees are not in there, then there's 25% cut or 50% cut, depending on where you take them from.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
The Division of Labor Standards and Safety over the last three budgets has already experienced $791,000 cut in 24% of the positions. We only had 104 positions in the first place, and we're at 80 at the present time.
Okay. Thanks. That answers my question. Thank you.
Are there any additional questions of Mr. Studi while we have him at the table near the microphone there? Thank you, Mr. Studi. If there are any further comment this time, I will put before us for adoption committee substitute for House Bill 65 by State Affairs that you have before us. Representative Ulmer.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would prefer us not to adopt this CS. I think we should stick with Labor and Commerce for the reasons that were mentioned by Representative Davis, for the reasons that both DEC and Department of Labor and Department of Natural Resources and a bunch of other agencies really need the authority, but also because of the basic philosophy involved here, which is that the user ought to pay. I mean, at some point, the user has to pay for the service that they receive. Who else should pay for it? The oil companies? The mining companies? I mean, who should pay for it? Somebody's got to pay, and it just seems to me the fairest approach is to have the person who gets the service pay for it, whether that's, you know, firewood in a state park or somebody getting an electrical inspection, and somebody, otherwise it's going to get subsidized. It's going to get subsidized in the same old way. It's going to come right out of Prudhoe Bay, and I think that mindset is fine for the 80s, but it won't work in the 90s, so I object to adopting this.
Okay. Would you like to do that formally with a roll call? Would the committee secretary please call the roll?
Representative Peacott?
Yes.
Representative Gary Davis?
No.
Representative Jerry Sanders?
Yes.
Representative Frank Ulmer?
No.
Representative Harley Olberg?
Yes.
Representative Betty Davis?
No.
Representative Albee?
Yes. We have adopted, have before us for formal consideration, a committee substitute by House State Affairs for House Bill number 65. Additional comment? If there is any additional comment or discussion, we can act on the bill. Okay, I'll put the motion before us that we pass committee substitute by House State Affairs for House Bill number 65 from the House State Affairs Committee with individual recommendations. Would the committee secretary please call the roll?
Representative Betty Davis?
This is to pass it out of committee?
Pass it out of committee.
Yes.
Representative Gary Davis?
Yes.
Representative Jerry Sanders?
Yes.
Representative Pete Cott?
Yes.
Representative Fran Ulmer?
Yes.
Representative Harley Olberg?
Yes.
Representative Albies?
Yes. Committee substitute for House Bill number 65 by the House State Affairs Committee has passed from this committee with individual recommendations. And the next committee referral is Judiciary. next item on our agenda, that one got out of order, is... House Bill number 197 regarding the Alyeska Settlement Fund. This bill is by Representative Olberg. Representative Olberg, would you care to make a statement on this bill for us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would. Very brief, very simple. House Bill 197 is an act making an appropriation to the Alyeska Settlement Fund and making appropriations from the Alyeska Settlement Fund and providing for an effective date. House Bill 197 appropriates $28,200,000 from the Alyeska Settlement Fund as stipulated under the agreement and consent decree dated November 25th, 1992. I did not include that in your package, but I've got all the relevant points highlighted if you have questions. This agreement and consent decree contains blackmail clauses which necessitates that action be taken this session, or in fact the agreement is either the funds, as I understand it, would revert to the trustee council. Which this is a very simple bill. It merely appropriates, as defined in the settlement decree, should be noted that the original agreement totaled $31,700,000. Of that amount, House Bill 197 appropriates $28,200,000. Upon the funding date, Alyeska paid the federal government $2 million for expenses incurred and paid the state of Alaska $1,005,000 for 1989 tax revenues under AS 43.75, which was lost raw fish taxes, I understand it. And that was refunded to local governments. So probably the first question you have is, what's this blackmail clause? And in fact, whether we like it or not, the state of Alaska has agreed in this settlement proposal that if either of these projects is rendered impossible because appropriations from the Alyeska Settlement Fund for the purposes specified are not enacted on or before September 15, 1993, then the money is not appropriated, will be treated as excess funds under subparagraph B above. Subparagraph B above specifies that excess funds will be paid into the joint trust fund. The joint trust fund is that gigantic black hole that the Alyeska trustees, trustee council controls, a place where $240 million has been deposited, $197 million has been spent, and there's no evidence of it in an impacted area. The first $197 million spent by the trustee council was to reimburse the state of Alaska, the federal government, and Exxon for their expenses associated with some of their spill work. So it is the essence of simplicity, whether you agree constitutionally or not, that the Attorney General or the Governor has the authority to include things like blackmail clauses and specify how funds are being to be paid to specific projects. There it is.
Representative Olberg, thank you very much for that informative statement. Good background material. Are there questions of Representative Olberg? Representative
Olmer. Would you like to walk us through the proposed CS versus the original, and would you like to talk to us about the decisions about how it's been led?
I have not physically seen the proposed CS.
There is a proposed committee substitute in your packets. We have not discussed it yet.
I have my
since we have persons that are here to testify on HB 197, perhaps we should get to them before we get into discussion.
I believe it. Is Craig Tillery here?
I am.
Were you to answer questions or testify?
Yes, sir.
I have an Ann Weiland here who would like to testify on HB 197. Is Ann Weiland here?
She left.
Weiland? Okay. We have Greg Tillery? Tillery? Would you like to testify on HB 197?
Yes, sir.
Please, if you would join us at the table. state your name and affiliation and your, give us your testimony if you would.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Craig Tillery. I'm with the Alaska Department of Law. Here at the request of Mr. Holberg to testify on HB 197. HB 197 is a bill that comes out of a settlement entered into between the state of Alaska, Alyeska Pipeline Company, the owner companies of Alyeska, and the United States government. That settlement was a culmination of 3 years of litigation involving a substantial number of state dollars in that litigation. We support the appropriation for the purposes stated in the bill. As I indicated, this was a joint settlement between those three primary entities. And although it was a joint settlement with the United States giving up substantial claims, virtually all the money that is coming from the settlement will go to state projects. Those are projects that were developed with consultation at all stages of the settlement process with them, Representative Jean Covina. The major concern I'd like to point out for the committee today is one responsibility the state has under the settlement, which is found in page 12 of the settlement, and that is that the state will have the final authority and responsibility for the design, specification, and implementation of response projects. What this means to the legislature is that it is necessary that the state maintain control, and the court will hold it accountable, and the United States government will hold us accountable for making sure that these projects go forward. If that is, you know, if that is a wish of this body. In other words, we can't simply give that money away to someone, say you go build it, and the state have no further role. The state ultimately sort of must have some oversight or control of that process. I have not seen the committee substitute. There were some technical changes that are probably appropriate in the bill, and my guess is that they might be in that committee substitute, but they related to the description of the projects to be done. I believe there was a somewhat similar bill in the Senate that had a more complete description, and on review of that, it appeared to me that that was probably a better description. There are also a few more technical matters, but they're relatively small. I can report to the committee that we have received the first payment from Alyeska under the settlement. It totaled about $6.2 million to us and a little bit less than $2 million to the United States. We have also, in light of this bill, in light of the bill that's been introduced in the Senate, and in light of the fact that we have entered into an agreement with several entities for the purchase of lands in Kachemak Bay, we have provided the first notice to Alyeska that we will be likely seeking to invoke the acceleration clause and asking for additional funds this year. That concludes my testimony on behalf of the bill, and I'm available for questions.
Since you are here with the Department of Law, I think the single issue that bothers me the most about this bill is the appropriation authority that I feel the administration is usurping from the legislature. Now, the Constitution of the state is extremely clear about revenues not being dedicated. It is the legislature that is the appropriation arm of our government. Not really trying to put you on the spot, because I'm sure that your immediate supervisor may not have an official opinion on this, but can you comment on that?
I believe that as a legal matter, this kind of a settlement is within the constitutional common law statutory authority of the Attorney General. What the committee should be aware of is the sort of practical problems that we're facing the state in negotiating a settlement. Specifically, this was a three-part agreement. There were three entities, all of whom had to essentially agree. Alyeska was not going to settle without the United States being involved. The United States was not going to settle. If monies were just given to the state of Alaska, Alyeska was not going to settle by writing a check to the state of Alaska. It wanted to get this whole thing over with at once, and Alyeska, my understanding of their process, they analyzed the case the state had against them, concluded it was not strong, concluded, however, that they were willing to pay money to get both of the governments out of the lawsuit. We analyzed our case against Alyeska, and it was not the strongest case that I have ever had in a court. It was very expensive to continue with this litigation. We believe that this amount of money represented as much or more than, in fact, more than we could get if we went to trial. It would cut short the expense. expenditure of vast sums on the litigation. And it represented a way to bring money into the state of Alaska for projects. Again, I would note that Representative Kabina, then representative for that area, was involved along the way in the settlement negotiations. But in light of all of those considerations, it was felt that this was, as a practical matter, an appropriate way to resolve the lawsuit. It was also felt, looking at the legal matters, that there was authority with the Attorney General to enter into this kind of a settlement where you provide for projects that relate to the issues that were under litigation and environmental lawsuit.
Thank you. Are there additional questions? Representative Olbert.
Perhaps Mr. Tillery could address the change in the committee substitute. The committee substitute eliminates the $7.5 million appropriation for Kachemak Bay. It simply deletes that section.
I guess I'm not sure I understand the purpose of that, but this appropriation, the monies in this appropriation are tied up. We would have to do a similar appropriation for those funds anyway, unless you simply want to try to delete that project. If the intent is to delete the project, and then, of course, that's the thing that the committee can vote on. But if the intent is to do that appropriation in another location, we're going to have to repeat the same appropriation. It can't be done in, for example, the same appropriation as money would come out of some other fund. It seems to me that it's simpler to do it in this bill if it is the legislature's intention to appropriate money for that project.
It's not my substitute.
No, I put the substitute forward. I find it extremely offensive that we're buying the state of Alaska, one of the most land-rich landowners in the world, is buying land that wasn't even impacted by this oil spill. I know thousands of timber owners in the state of Alaska that would like to compete for the opportunity to sell their timberlands to the state for this kind of money. And I think this idea of buying timberland in Kachemak Bay for an oil spill that occurred in Prince William Sound, though some traces of it did get to Cook Inlet, I just find it personally offensive. It has to do some other people. This is the new legislature this year. Not the same makeup as last year. So I guess the committee substitute is to throw forth the idea, well, you have this settlement. We're not going to interfere. We're not going to go along with something that we don't feel appropriate. We're not going to authorize spending the money in this direction.
Mr. Chairman, my comments were sort of directed at this. I wasn't sure whether this was a substantive, like one didn't like that appropriation, whether it was a technical attempt to do
no, it. No, it just removes that appropriation.
The reason that Kachemak Bay was in this bill was the trustee council had received numerous comments as sort of the most, the restoration project that had received the most focus of any that we had, you know, we had gotten prior to the settlement. There are provisions in this bill that provide for benefits to the Prince William Sound area. There have been other activities by the trustee council that have provided for items that have assisted in the Kodiak areas impacted by this bill. And while perhaps Cook Inlet didn't receive as great an impact, certainly as Prince William Sound did, and possibly as Kodiak, it did receive some impact. There was oiling on Kachemak Bay beaches. And it was felt that this was an appropriate restoration project in some way of indicating to the people in that area that it was that there was concern for the impacts that they endured.
President Olver.
I have a couple of process questions. What are the rules associated with how the money gets spent? What are the constrictions around whether you use it on ferries or roads or buying storage facilities or health care? What are the rules?
There are the projects that it can be used on are described in here, in the settlement document.
Could you refer me to the particular section?
Oh, I'm sorry, it's in the settlement document, not the...
Well, it's in the bill
it's
also.
It's not in the agreement.
Well, the
bill defines the there are three projects.
Right,
four
but
projects.
Where did they come from, and what are the rules in the agreement that describes what the money can be spent on?
Okay. Under paragraph 8 of the agreement, it provides that the monies deposited in the Alaska Settlement Fund shall be dispersed solely for the following purposes and subject to the following allocation. $1.5 million for construction of a stock storage facility.
Excuse me, what page are you on?
Page 9. My apologies.
Okay, you're on page 9. I'm on page 9. And where are you?
Paragraph 8.
Okay.
And if you look at 8A, that describes the docks. 8B describes the construction of a road from Bordeaux to Shepherd Point. 8C describes the Cashmere Bay appropriation. 8D is for money for communications equipment to go into Valdez Emergency Operations Center. And in addition, these are the basic descriptions. In addition to these, there are some appendices to the settlement agreement which sort of provide guidelines or understandings of what sort of more detailed understandings of the scope of this project. An example of that would be that the docs sort of talk about the response docs, but in one of the appendices, there is a specific mention that with respect to the dock at Chenega, it is expected that its construction may involve removal of a contaminated site that is virtually the same location as something people in Chenega are very concerned about. It's a source of environmental hazard to them. And so we don't know that that's going to be necessary or possible to move that site, but it's mentioned in that appendices as one of the things that, so people would understand that it was permissible.
Okay, and procedurally, if the legislature does not appropriate the money for these projects, what happens next?
At the insistence of the United States, the money would then go into the joint trust fund, joint federal-state trust fund, where it could be expended at the discretion of the federal-state trustees. Of course, the state has a veto power over the use of those funds, but there's nothing we can do to make something happen.
So the money does not disappear. It doesn't leave the state of Alaska.
No.
It just goes into gives the discretion to the joint trustee council as to whether or not they will choose to spend the money on these projects, conceivably, or anything else.
That's correct. And in fact, these trustee council rules under the MOA require the money be spent in the state of Alaska. So regardless, it's not going to leave the state of Alaska.
Other questions of Mr. Tillery? Representative Gary Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You just mentioned the veto power of who? Over the Joint Trustees Council?
Well, excuse me, sir. The Trustee Council works under a requirement of unanimous consent, and the practical effect is that either government could veto a project, and no government can push one by ribbons.
I heard the veto. I knew that was the case. I thought maybe there was a higher authority that could come down. Mr. Chairman, I feel compelled to speak about the substitute, the leading Kachemak Bay. I've been a part of the community to some degree, being from Soldatna and Kachemak Bay in from Homer, and I've opposed the buyback of Kachemak Bay for a number of years, and I've done that publicly for a number of years, and it's almost getting to the point that let's find some money somewhere and get this thing off the table. But I still have a lot of concern about the precedent. I hear rumors of other timber leases now that are being looked at as opportunity to be bought back by the state under this. The Kenai River, the Cook Inlet was affected by the oil spill. The Kenai River, which runs through the middle of Soldatna, was impacted to a degree by the closing down of the commercial fisheries the year of the spill, because of oil in the inlet. So the Kenai River was impacted by excessive runs of salmon in the river, and I have a $10 million, I've been after $10 million for I don't know how many years to relocate what I feel is a contaminated site within the city of Soldatna right on the Kenai River. So I could use $10 million of this too. I've looked at the Kachemak Bay buyback as a beautification effort to the city of Homer ever since day one because of that. The $10 million that I've been after for the city of Soldatna is a beautification effort and also an environmental cleanup type effort to the city of Soldatna. And I feel, since it affects the Kenai River, it's to the
citizens of the state of Alaska. There's no doubt that coming, that protection of the Kachemak Bay lands is a very viable request. As you, those who have been to Homer, as you drive down the hill into the city, view the spit and the beautiful Kachemak Bay and the forested mountains on the other side, there's no doubt it would be a travesty. That may be a little strong word. It would be unsightly to see a logged mountain on the other side. But we can try and preserve it. I'm still in a dilemma. After all the years that I've known of the issue, and I'm currently trying to get the state off the dollar to stop the beetle infestation on the entire peninsula. It's spreading like wildfire. 5 years ago, when I first checked on the possibility of beetle infestation in Kachemak Bay Park, I checked with people who own land and live over there. It was 7 miles away. There was beetle infestation 7 miles from Kachemak Bay State Park, and I believe that was about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. So all of these things combined, it puts me in a real dilemma. I've been opposed to it, but I can certainly see some benefits from it. I can, it's without seeing a complete list of projects that this money would go to, it's really hard for me to sit here and try and decide one against the other without seeing a complete list of where this money should go. So I just wanted to state that for the record, and I still don't know which button I'll push.
Over.
Thank you. In response to that, there are four projects defined in the bill. $14.5 million for the building of docks and storage facilities in Chenega and Tetlik. $6 million for a road to Shepherd Point. And $7.5 million for Kachemak, $200,000 for communications equipment. That is the sum total of the projects.
Mr. Chairman, but that's of this bill, which doesn't deal with the entitled. With the total amount of dollars that will be available under this account.
Oh, the difference is, excuse me. I referenced that $2 million of the $32 million has already been paid to the federal government, and $1.5 million has already been paid through the state for lost raw fish taxes. That's, and I think there's one other. Seems like there's one other small item somewhere. Do you recollect?
Thank you.
That's 31.7 less 3.5. Yeah, no, that accounts for it.
Yep. It was my understanding that the Alyeska Settlement Fund was a $50 million.
Oh, excuse me. This is a totally separate $31,700,000 fund. The other, you're talking about the old House Bill 411, $50 million. This is a completely separate $31,700,000.
Well, that's great. Another $31 million I didn't even know we had.
And I wish we didn't. Yeah, this is not the old Christmas tree. This is a settlement. This is a settlement just reached in November of 1992. And perhaps the old Christmas tree had something to do with the definition of these projects.
I have a question for Representative Obert, I guess, or I'm not sure who wants to answer it, but this was entered into in November of 92.
Yes, ma'am.
I guess most of us were sort of busy in November of 92. I wasn't paying a lot of attention, I admit, but I'm a little